Hello and welcome to One Inch Plus Scary Podcast. This is Kirsty Sayer. It is August 24th, 2022. I hope you're doing okay, you guys. It is back to school time and I'm sitting in my silent house. It is so damn weird. It feels like forever since I've been in a house this quiet. It is disquieting in the quietness. My sidekick Sharka is here, as always, to keep me company. So if you hear him, I guess I'm not entirely alone. So that's a good thing. It's been a while since I spoke to you alone. I do hope that you heard last week's podcast episode with Joe Boyle. We love Joe. He spoke to me at the very beginnings of my podcast. He was one of my first guests, one of my first episodes, and he made so many friends through that podcast episode. There were so many people who were inspired by him and became friends with him, and I just love that. And he was back to talk about how he's doing and his latest passion project, and it was such a good episode. It was really relevant to what so many people are going through. It helps everybody who wants to be a helper to listen to somebody like Joe get vulnerable and honest about what helps and what hurts when you're going through really, really tough times, as he has, with so much courage and fortitude and good humor. But just, he's real. He's just so real. And it was just a real gift. And so I really encourage you to go listen to that. If you already did, thank you so much. How are you doing? I asked you that already. Hopefully okay. I'll tell you what, I was not okay recently, not at all. I'm starting to get okay. I'm starting to feel better. Joe and I talked about the hazards of becoming a brand in people's minds and how we can unwittingly start to sort of become a type of person that people count on us to be, and that can create a bunch of really toxic pressure. And I hope that I don't do that, and I never have. There are times, we talked about this in the episode as well, where I really kind of shook people up because I was not the good sort of stalwart Mormon that I always had been when I started to sort of leave the church and navigate that faith crisis in a very public way. There's been times where people weren't really as jazzed about my online persona because I was covering the difficult, the real, the very gritty, the often ugly side of PTSD. And that included a lot of anger, and that made some people uncomfortable, which was a them problem rather than a me problem, which I now see in retrospect. But it was hard. It felt like a lot of extra pressure when people would tell me, I used to find you so uplifting and encouraging, and you just were such a breath of fresh air and light and radiance in the world, and now you're so dark and so angry. It was super sad and unhelpful. But there were enough people that would also come out and go, the fact that you're being so honest with your struggles, the fact that you're showing that it's okay for a woman, to be honest about her anger and to really embrace it as part of her healing. I've referred endlessly to my rage stage and how I felt that it was a critical turning point in my, healing from the trauma that led to complex PTSD, and how I think that anger is a healthy human emotion that we've demonized and that we've essentially stolen from people, especially women, we've become afraid of, and it doesn't serve us. Anger is a refiner's fire, and it often will help us to create boundaries and to see very, very clearly what we do and what we do not want, and to burn away the excess, and it's a good thing. So, you know, I know that for as many people as I may have turned off or frightened away by being very real with whatever I was going through, I've also helped people. And I was reminded of that and of that very that mission that I take very seriously and always have, to be honest about what I'm going through. And, you know, when I wrote my blog, I always felt like I was being, you know, in the early days where it was a chronicle of my life as a young Mormon mom. And I felt like I was being very honest in my portrayal. In fact, that's how it began. It began with me telling stories of chaos and just funny mishaps that happened to me as a mom of young kids, which turned into a column for a while, a paid column, basically just the chaos of motherhood. And then that expanded into a blog, which became quite a lot more nuanced. But there were times where I just came across as really happy. And to be honest, I remember at the time being really happy amidst all the things that I was juggling with in the background of my psyche. Those were happy days. And I wrote about the things that I enjoyed and wanted to remember. And so during that time, I do remember being as authentic as I could on my blog. But I now see that I was living, my overall life was living on other people, was being lived on other people's terms. And so it's a little more complicated, you know, than it might have seemed at the time. But now I'm very confident in sharing. For the most part, I'm fairly confident. I shouldn't say I'm very, but it comes and goes. The waves of confidence come and go with sharing how I'm doing, because I am so convicted that it is one of the kindest things we can do as human beings to share the struggles, not just the enormous struggles, not just the you know, the devastation and the grief when something horrifically unthinkable, unspeakably awful happens. And that's a huge gift that so many brave people are able to give. They give, you know, they're able to give people a path or insight. Joe talked about being almost a guide dog to cancer, which I just thought was...
I don't know how to respond to that.
Oh, Siri doesn't know how to respond to that. And thank God she just said that, because that brings up something. I love that. The timing of that was impeccable. That brings up something else. It's just so relevant and so real. That sometimes people don't know how to respond. And I was talking to that with a friend who's grieving something just so significant. I was talking to her yesterday about how sometimes people don't respond well. They do not give the response that we need. They're trying, or they don't know how to respond, so they don't respond at all. And it can be devastating, right? I talked about that at the beginning regarding Joe's episode and how important it is to listen to people, tell us what they need and what they don't need. It's just as important when we can to be the people talking about what we do need and what we don't need, if we possibly can, if we have the capacity to offer that to other people. In the midst of it, and a couple weeks ago, I just didn't have the capacity to offer anything to anyone. And I don't mind saying so, you know, it just wasn't the season for me to be helping or talking about anything. But I can now, and I'll tell you, man, I'd say things start to get really weird for me at the beginning of June. I was really conscious that I was moving into kind of a disassociated state. But it made sense because things were really busy and they were changing quickly and a lot of things were happening at the same time. And it was almost useful. So I could, I sort of embraced it, just going through the motions while being aware, you know, the wise part of myself was like, girl, you're in danger, girl. And I, in retrospect, that would have been a really good time to look into therapy, or any time before then, and lock down some kind of therapy, because therapy is hard come by these days, sadly. It is hard to get on somebody's schedule. And if you're feeling even a glimmer, even a hint that you might be needing some therapy, please look into that aggressively now. Because I'll tell you, I did aggressively. I had help and connections and everything, and I still haven't locked down a therapist, which I probably needed back in June or long before then. So here is my PSA. Therapists are hard to find, but worthwhile. And if you sense that you're needing help, but you're not at the sort of emergent phase, don't wait. just get on that right now. Okay. That said, back in June, feeling that numbness should have been a hint, because the numbness, the disassociation has predictably, if I look back on the patterns of life, it has been a precursor to a big ass spiral. And, you know, I should have seen that spiral coming, because a lot of changes that had the potential to be very triggering were on their way, and I was aware of that. Kids being at the age of that I was when I left home, triggers have always triggered me. It's triggered me as a mom, and it's triggered my own stuff. Really, really ties into a lot of the abandonment wounds. And then at the same time as preparing to move two of my kids out of town, one permanently, who's starting, you know, his adult life at the other side of the country, which is both a wonderful thing and a really sad and hard thing, for me anyway, and then the other going several hours away to college, which is also a new thing, wonderful for him, difficult for me, but at the same time, you know, a sign of success as a mom. You know, isn't this what we're preparing to do? This is what we've been striving to do all this time, is make them independent, help them fill their goals and dreams. Okay, all that stuff. So I knew that was coming. I also said goodbye to my friend who I'd become so close to when things got really, really narrow. And, you know, our circles got tiny and became like basically a dot during the pandemic. I took that so literally, man. My circle became a dot. I had one friend with whom I did everything. She was safe. I could count on her not bringing COVID home to my kids. She and I were soul sisters. We had this, you know, just similar views on most things. I adored and loved her, and she was tons of fun. And she was getting done with her PhD, so I drove her across the country. I drove with her across the country to California, which was something awesome that I'd been looking forward, that I've wanted to do for since I left California. So that was a great opportunity. And but we were talking about it recently, and just cackling by how weird it was. We both felt so weird and so disassociated the entire time, and processing that now and going, damn, was that weird or what? And I just sort of put down the, like, the emoji of the two people with the big white eyes, and I was like, this is how we were the whole time. Like, we didn't realize, but, and of course we had moments of fun and hilarity, but a lot of the time we were just like, what? And I think that the two of us were individually and together sort of just processing in a very weird way with, you know, all of her stuff, her plants and her dog in a car as we drove across country, what the last 2 or 3 years had meant. And they had meant very different things for both of us, but also the same thing to the entire planet. We had all been through a major shift, that wasn't necessarily a positive one overall. And, you know, the hits kept coming there for a while, and we are very unclear of whether they will stop coming. You know, our sense of safety and security in so many different ways has changed. Our social landscapes for a lot of us have changed drastically. I know mine has. It's basically unrecognizable now. And so I just felt like, whoa, everything's changed, and not even my bestie's here, and now my other besties are leaving, and my role as a mother is changing. And so by July came, I was not okay. And by the end of July, I was super not okay, and I had to really admit to myself I wasn't okay. I think my family had seen that I was not okay. They saw me becoming progressively more and more sort of like slug-like, you know. And I was like, why can't I, you know, do things? But then towards the end of July, I was having some major meltdowns, man. I had a panic attack, a massive one, or a couple, that I have not had in forever. I wasn't ever particularly prone to panic attacks. And I just, and they were always so inconveniently timed, like on a beach. On a beach, really? That's where you're going to have your panic attack? On a beautiful beach, on a beautiful day? On your very, like, rare vacation with your family, that's when the panic attack is going to roll up? Perfect. Awesome. Nicely timed for everyone. Well done, Kirsty. So then I'm adding shame to the timing of my mental breakdown because it's inconvenient and traumatic for everybody, which it was, which I'm not going to say it wasn't. Like, when you have PTSD, you're not taking just yourself along for the ride. If you have a family, they're along for that ride, and that is not a fun ride. And so signs of that are going to traumatize your family, and it is sad, and there's no saying it's not. It's traumatic. It triggers them. It's traumatic in and of itself. It's just not a good time. And even though it was something outside of my control, I felt a great deal of shame. And so after the just like spinning out phase came the shame spiral. And it had to do with a lot of things. And I just love to try to compartmentalize things so that I can tackle them. This is this, and so it will require this ingredient to fix. And it's not. There's just too many things. It's a cocktail. It's a messy, messy, depressing cocktail right now for me to work my way through. And I have just had to accept that. Not just, you know, massive life changes, but hormonal changes in myself always. As women, we are constantly like, our bodies are reinventing their own hormone cocktails every 5 to 7 minutes, it seems like. That aside, that's small potatoes when you decide that you're going to start messing with your ADHD medication, and that stuff is basically meth. Okay, so I'm on amphetamines. Yep, amphetamine speed, basically. Okay, that's what Adderall is. I didn't like the Adderall. I'm one of the few, well, I'm sure, no, I shouldn't say few. I'm sure there's plenty of us who do not like feeling like wired, right? It's a gross feeling. I don't know why people abuse that drug, to be honest. It's not a bunch of fun. I'm not a fan. And I would tolerate it so that I could just get a modicum of stuff done. I could focus. I could remember, you know, a name 10 seconds after it was told to me, you know, just real like, or how to drive, stuff like that. My working memory without medication has become shockingly bad. And so I recognized I absolutely need to be on something, but I didn't want to feel wired. And it was starting to make me feel sick all the time. And I didn't like that. So I switched to another one and I didn't like how that was feeling. It was too high of a dose. And so then I was feeling like a zombie because too much speed for somebody with ADHD makes them into a zombie. They just get very, very tired. Yeah, it's so much fun. So it's actually a very delicate balance. And if you didn't know about that, which I didn't at first, there you go. Now you do. So the whole ADHD medication thing, oof, guys, it is a mission. It really is. And it's, I think it must be particularly complicated for females, just because we've got so much going on. And so I have been struggling with that, and I went, you know, I had the very misguided idea, and I must have not been in my right mind because this just seems so unwise, and I'm usually quite careful and in quite, you know, I'm very dedicated to talking to my doctor about doing things that affect me medically. I was like, well, if I was on too high of a dose for a while there, maybe I should just go on no dose for a while just to kind of calibrate my body. It doesn't do that, you guys. It does not do that. It causes you to become unhinged, shall we say. In my case, I would say unhinged was a fair word. I was extremely irritable and depressed, and damn, it was just messy. The cocktail just became very swirly. The sadness cocktail, the depression cocktail, the processing cocktail then just started to become like swirly on top of everything. It was scary. So I would not recommend. Zero stars, didn't like it. And so when, you know, you may ask me about how was summer, nothing horrific happened, thank God. you know, on its face, on paper, it was fine. It was just fine. Personally, I would say I did not have a great time. I'm not going to look back on this summer with endless memories of fondness and gladness. I'm really grateful that everybody got to where they were going safely without incident. Huge blessings all around. Very grateful for that. We're always grateful for a break from drama, absolutely. But for me personally, I haven't been having a good time. And I'm not ashamed to say so. And it got to the point a couple of weeks ago where I just was like spinning in my mind going, I don't know who I am. Who have I been, and what do the last two decades, particularly the last two decades, what do I have to show for them? Five kids doing their thing. You know, I've got college graduates and everybody's being, you know, productive in their lives, and they're good. They're damn good people. I'm proud of every single one of them. They're kind, wonderful humans who have great morals, and they try to live closely by them. And, you know, now that I'm out of this intense, depressive episode, I can see that clearly. And, you know, but people were telling me that when I was in them, and I was just like it was as if they were speaking another language. And that is, I have vast experience with that. I have been there 100 times, and that therein also lies the problem. I've spoken endlessly about how when you've circled the drain enough times, if you go back and you start to swirl around it again, it gets very dangerous and very scary, right? Just like I talked about how triggering it was for my family to see me starting to, you know, display episodes of PTSD again, or to be panicked, or to be very depressed, or to be volatile. It was very traumatic and triggering. It is also very traumatic and triggering to be living that again, because I knew how close to, you know, being sucked all the way in I had been. And this time I was convinced, this is it, man. This is it, because I don't have a future to cling to. Like, if this is what happens, is I prepare myself to be abandoned? Damn, I don't think that was a good idea, what I did, because now I'm left, and what am I supposed to do? Now, that in itself wasn't clean and cut and dried either. It was very messy because, yes, while my pack of four have now been officially launched and they are independent for the most part, although I tell my husband that they're in my mind all day long and they always will be, I see things like I see the days of the week and I see the months of the year in sort of a diagram fashion. That's how my mind works. It pictures things geographically laid out and in color and everything. And my kids are no different. I think about them throughout the day. I rotate through them constantly. You know, my mind goes to them like throughout the hour. On the hour, every hour, my thoughts rotate through my children to check on how they're doing. Even if it's just, you know, in my own mind, and I see them in all of the way I've laid out their geographical locations in my idea of my Kirstie map. And it's so funny. Your kids just do not leave your mind, and they're never independent from your care for them and your love for them. But essentially this pack of four who I identified with so strongly, because I was in arrested development, to be very honest, for a good deal of the time that I was raising them. They were my pack. You know, I've always said I feel like I'm part of the pack. I kind of feel like the older sister. So the abandonment wounds were really, really fresh. And now, having, you know, done the work, of course, I sort of transitioned toward the end into being their mother, and I very much firmly see them as their mother. It was tugging with my pack is leaving me, and now I'm left to the work of being a mom, and I'm fully unprepared to mother a single child who does not have siblings around her to buffer her from my whatever the hell it is that I'm going to do to mess this up. Because to be perfectly honest, I think, you know, my kids have each other so much to thank. Of course, my spouse is wonderful, and I'm sure I did wonderful things too. The buffer of having kind, loving, involved, supportive siblings cannot be understated. That is an enormous privilege that they had, and they were very lucky. We've all been very lucky that the combination of personalities of the kids in our family has always been a supportive and kind one. And so I'm just like, here's this poor, lonely, single child being left with me. I don't know how to do this. So I can't just go into mourning and take to my bed or crawl into a hole as a has-been mother. I now have to be a whole different kind of mother that I don't know how to be. And this poor kid doesn't have siblings to buffer her on board. And she's going to be so lonely. And now I have to worry about that too. And oh my hell. So I had this like the sense of abandonment, the sense of, of being the Arrested Development pack mate, the sense of sadness of just a normal healthy mother has at, you know, her children moving far away, the sense of pride that a normal healthy mother has and joy and wanting to be supportive of that and not be a damper on the whole thing. But I also just had a pure sense of fear that I was in this high-stakes environment and I was about to screw it up royally. Just didn't know how to do it, wasn't particularly jazzed about it, never wanted to be the mother of just one kid. I just always knew that was not my bag and I was not going to be good at it. Well, I'm going to have to learn to be good at it. But all of this converged in one huge crashing wave. And at the same time, just this huge identity complex. I just lost all sense of myself. I could not possibly remember one single good thing I did. I felt no confidence in any single aspect of myself. I was like, who is this old, inept human being with no purpose? And the one purpose that she does have, she's terrified of. What the hell? This sucks. I hate this. I can't do this. I don't want to do this. Who am I? What am I? What the hell am I going to do? And I was spinning, to say the least. If you have had a fantastic summer, yay. If you've had a summer that's been absolutely appalling and abysmal, so sorry to hear about it. So sorry. Truly, it's the worst. Isn't summer just... I don't know, man. There's something about summer that sort of like makes hard times. It's one of those things. You know how holidays magnify stuff? Summer is like one long holiday, especially if you're on social media, because everybody's having the best time on social media. They're all on a boat, right? They're all on a boat and they're all looking fantastic with their swarms of friends and extended family and like amazing amounts of money coming from somewhere to just, you know, somehow support this boating, traveling lifestyle. And what's happening, man? Why am I not happy? Where are my people? Where's my money? Where is my boat? This is bad, right? Okay, so summer can be absolute hot garbage when you are not feeling yourself or you do not have a sense of purpose at the time, or you're struggling with a whole like identity crisis, or maybe you're sick, or maybe your finances are like strapped. Kind of all of the above for me. I just wasn't feeling well. I was struggling with an identity crisis, and you know, sending kids to college will break you financially, and so finances have just been rough, and it's just been, yeah, not the best of times. So I'm gonna be straight, you guys. It was a mess. It has been a mess. I feel like, though, I'm coming out of the mess. And I am going to tell you what's been helping after the break. So stay tuned. I'm back. And before the break, I was talking about how my summer wasn't it, as the kids these days would say. It was not it. Summer was not the vibes. The vibes were off. Super off, but they really reached a critical point a couple weeks ago. I was in the worst space. Was it a couple even? Maybe just as like maybe 10 days. It hasn't been long, you guys. It has not been long. I got to a point where I was like, yo, like, what the hell? What is it that people in these circumstances do? Because this is intolerable. And the weird thing is that we tend to isolate when we most need people or we most need the input of others. Kind of the shame. First we feel bad, then we lash out. We just act unhinged maybe or whatever, and we feel ashamed of ourselves or we just feel like we don't have anything to offer anybody and we're just too exhausted or whatever. So we tend to isolate, which is the worst, because what we really need is like space from the toxic voice in our mind that's telling us lies. And even if it's within our family, we have kind and wise people in our family who are trying to help us. What I said before about how, you know, they've all been caught in this same kind of energy loop as well. And so there's that trauma that we're all passing around. Sometimes you just need a completely fresh perspective, which is why, you know, therapy should have been sought and locked down long before this. Again, another shout out for that. I understand how hard it is, how expensive it is, how hard come by it is, because I am in the thick of that. So I really want to, as an aside, also say that, yes, I understand that therapy is both a desperately rare and expensive commodity in the society, and it shouldn't be, and not everybody can access it, at least in a traditional way. And since I couldn't, I did make moves, like I said before, and I am still in the process. I eventually was forced to do the next best thing. Now, I told you that I was isolating other than in my family, and wasn't being helpful because I was afraid, and indeed I was re-traumatizing members of my family who were trying to help me, including my husband, and I could sense it. And it's just, you need to look outside of your family as well. And I had been kind of closing up my friends as well, you know, who would help me. And this is where I want to give a shout out to, once again, the internet. The internet has saved my life, and I don't want to overstate that so many times. I have made some of my most meaningful and life-changing friendships online since online started. I was 22 when my first kid was born. I got onto the internet around the time when I was around 20. But I remember the parenting group that I became a part of when he was born. I'm still in touch with those people. He's 24. What am I saying? I was 22. He's now 24. So they're still part of my life 24 years later. They're some of my closest confidants. And I've met them in person, some of them several times, some of them never. And they continue to be my closest confidants, people I've met over the years online. I was basically shutting out everybody, my closest friends of all kinds. But there was this group that I actually only within maybe the last 4 or 5 years become a part of. And for some reason, I got the instinct on, you know, right when things were really, really peaking, to reach out to this group. I just knew that they would have my back. They were just people who I knew were well-versed in holding space for people, something that is so damn important in our society, something that I'm personally not very good at all, that I'm striving to get better at, which is just being able to witness somebody having a hard time and being willing to do the uncomfortable but amazingly supportive work of sitting with them for as long as it lasts and not pressuring them to get through it faster and just letting it be what it is and helping them in ways that they want us to help them and not offering ways that might feel good for us, but make them feel like they're on some kind of timeline or that they're unacceptable or their pain is unacceptable. And this particular group has shown me in the past that they're very, very good at this. They were a trusted, vetted group. In addition to that, I eventually did reach out to my one close friend that moved away that I talked about earlier. And she was really helpful to me. So sort of at the same time, I reached out to all these people, and they responded by holding space. They reminded me that while my feelings were valid and what I was going through was very difficult and very real and very understandable, it didn't encompass who I was. Those feelings that I was going through were real and hard, but they didn't embody me. and that I was a whole separate person from how I was feeling now, and that I would find that person again. And if I couldn't sense that now, just have faith in them. And just having somebody say that you admire and love and trust, saying you're a badass and you've been through a lot successfully and you've done many good things in your life. I'm telling you, you have. And just even if you can't fully take it on board, it's helpful. And knowing that it's not tied up with, so now cheer up and let's all go out and have fun, is even more helpful. They don't need you to be back, you know, just because they say that thing. They're not, you know, giving you a pep talk so you can go out and do something for them. They're willing to just sit with you for as long as it lasts, but they're willing to remind you that it does not define you, right? These are people that you need. And if you're in a weird space right now or a terrible space right now, I would encourage you so, so warmly and lovingly to find people like that. And you know what? A lot of us are very isolated in real life. A lot of us feel like, wow, everybody else has great swaths of friends that they go out on those boats with during summer, or, you know, bar hop with, or have picnics with, or do whatever the hell you see on curated Instagram feeds with. And I don't have anybody. It's okay, because the internet exists for good or for evil. And this is one way in which it exists for good. There are groups of people for every kind of circumstance that you can find yourself in, with kind, loving supporters in, with real hearts and real lives and real brains and real resources, and they're there. Do not give up, because internet friends are as real of friends as I've had, and I've had some really excellent in-person friends too. I can say that they're equally valuable and equally wonderful, and they're real. So don't let anybody tell you that an internet support group is not a real thing, or an internet friend is not a real friend. They're real. And that's wonderful. And it's a blessing of the internet. So find safe people. The other wonderful thing about the internet is that you can weed out so much less awkwardly the people who are toxic or just not hitting it right for you. You can find a group that's safe. And that can take a little bit of trial and error, but it's quite a bit easier to do it online than in person. Anyway, so there's my plug for you. Please don't feel inadequate or any weird way about looking for resources and help online at a time that so many people are very burnt out and dealing with so much. We all have to look at diversifying our resources from time to time. The person that you might have always counted on might have moved away, might, oh, God forbid, have died. Or they might just be so overwhelmed, or they just might not be up to, in this season of their life, meeting you how you need in the season of the life of your life that you're going through. They might just not understand it or have the right words or the right insight. So diversifying your support by looking online is good and worthy, and there's nothing weird or wrong with it. We're all doing it, and it's great. I had a lovely, beautiful friend reach out to me online recently, and she said, "Kirsty, you have so many friends. If you could tell me how to make friends, I would pay you $1 million if I could." And I was like, girl, right now I'm just like, I do not have a single friend. If I can tell you this honestly, I'm sitting here and I'm feeling like I do not have one single damn friend. And she's like, but that's so confusing to me because it seems like you have so many. I was like, well, that's cool. Let me know who they are. Because I was in a space where I was like, you're what the hell? You're asking the wrong person. I don't have any friends. I don't have a single one, because that's how it felt to me. And honestly, right now, when I think about my friend group, I'm leaning heavily toward the online right now. It's that season for me, and maybe it always will be, and that's just fine. There's no shame, and they're no less real. Okay, so that all said, but shout out to my real life friends. I love you, and I cherish you too, and thank you so much for being in my life. Don't want to minimize in real life friends either. All friends are friends, okay? Okay. So I was part of this group, and some part of me just really I really got the idea, you know, like you should tell them this particular set of worries that you're having, and they validated them, and they were like, you know, one was like, this thing I can completely identify with. It hit me in just the same way. And another one was, do not underestimate that one thing that you just mentioned in passing in this whole cocktail of problems that you feel like you're having, because that is so intense and that is so hard. And I don't think you realize so how hard it is. And the validation of that and just kind of opening the window from the closed circuit that was my home life and the people inside of my home, who, you know, were trying to help me, and I'm so grateful for them, but it was just really life-giving and so helpful. And I immediately took the edge of how difficult that was. And I sort of, so I felt like a little glimmer of my old self. I felt that tiny bit of confidence, like, okay, I might be a hot mess, but I can still write and I can still express myself. And these people are responding and they're giving me so much validation, and they're telling me that I'm not weak and I'm not pathetic and I'm not like out of pocket for feeling this way when I should in fact be feeling happy because there was no actual drama this, you know, season of my life, for which I am, by the way, extremely grateful and cognitive of. And I always say, you know, it's when we're sitting around going, ah, I long for the good old days, that are the good old days are happening right there. And don't long for the past, because you might be well long for the time, for the past in which you were longing for the past. Does that make sense? Like, I try to stay cognitive of that, and it's easier than ever to do since the pandemic. But they were just so incredibly validating that even in the good, you know, the ostensibly good things with kids doing what they're supposed to be doing and fulfilling their dreams, there's sadness, and it's complicated, and it's difficult. And, you know, without giving advice, because that's kind of one of the rules, is like, they're very judicious in giving advice. They're more about validation, which is so, so rare to find in our society. We've been built by capitalism to solve problems in the least amount of time and as efficiently as possible. And that is not how humans and emotions work, you guys. And so we've got to be retrained by our souls and ourselves and our sisters to be able to hold space, and our brothers too. I've had wonderful space holding men in my life over the years. So, and you know, they were just like, we see you and we acknowledge what you're feeling is real and difficult. And we also know that this thing does not define you and that you are so much more than what you feel right now. And we're going to be with you until you see her again. And she's there, but you're seeing with, you know, cloudy glasses, and it's going to be okay. And that's really all I needed. That little scared, feeling abandoned part of me just needed that sense of comfort and sisterhood and acknowledgement. And that is, you know, what holding space means. And it's so damn important. And if you don't have somebody in your life who's doing it, don't stop looking until you do. And online is where you find them really easily. And you will stumble on those people in real life sometimes. But if you're not in circumstances right now to be stumbling around geographically in real time, stumble around the internet. Do yourself a favor. So I you know, sort of had an urge to, it was really, I don't know, it was something that I had always intended to do. Once I get Finney settled, then it is now time to revisit grad school, which I will remind you, I had started actually years ago. And I had started my degree in mental health counseling, only to discover when I was knee deep in case studies of child abuse that, my word, I had much, much trauma to deal with, which is when I put the brakes on that and went and did 5 years of very intensive therapy. And you know, I knew I had no business in trying to be a therapist until that was addressed. And I'm so grateful that that first foray into, you know, trying to get my master's in this field led to me actually being able to heal It was a trigger to me being able to heal. And I think there's a big mental block, because the last time I, you know, walked this path, I had to do a lot of work, which was very, very difficult and traumatic in itself. And so there's, you know, a lot of fears and mental blocks, but there was also part of me that was like, now's the time. Don't, feet don't fail me now. If you don't do it now, you're not going to do it. You got to jump right in. And so I just felt so ill prepared and so exhausted and so not confident when I, even contemplated it. I was like, I know I need to do this now. There's a part of myself that's telling the rest of myself, and it's a true and real side of me that is saying, now's the time. But man alive, I'm terrified. I'm exhausted. I'm burnt out. I am so lacking in confidence. I just don't think I can do it. And certainly I don't want to, which is honestly, in almost every circumstance, a really good sign to stay far away from something. But still, there was something that instinctively told me inside of me, you know what, talk to somebody about this and see where that's all coming from. So with the help of this group of people and, you know, very trusted friends, but it's a small group of people, you know, you might want to just keep your, you know, when you're really struggling and feeling tender and vulnerable and you are like floating a very big idea past people, you want to make sure that those people are 100% have your back, that they do not have any kind of weird stuff that might make them scared to see you succeed or to move into another phase of your life, because that can be really derailing. I've been there, done that. So just be very careful. And this is why I honestly didn't want to talk to anybody about, you know, going back to grad school. I wanted to be really, really judicious about who I discussed that with, because I knew it was loaded for me. But, you know, I was able to talk it through into which parts in particular I was finding terrifying. And they offered my ADHD brain sort of ways to break it down into very manageable bite-sized pieces. And not just that, they also offered to support me in really tangible ways that made it not seem so terrifying, so lonely, so over the top, exhausting. Okay. And so that part was huge for me, is that if you are like me and you have an ADHD brain where you want to do big things and you have big goals, but you can only see them in huge tasks, you can't break things down in bite-sized pieces, that's okay. That's not your fault. But you, guess what? You are blessed with people in the world with other brains who can take things and make them small for you. And so have them do that for you. Enlist their help in saying, first you do this and then you do that. And if you need help with this, you can go to that person or this person or even me. And that's what these blessed people did. And so I realized, you know, the first part of grad school is the application process, and a large part of that is the essay writing. And to be honest, that was very tiring for me. It was a really intense process, which was extremely tiring because it dealt with a ton of triggering material. But what it did do was also just really remind me of how much I've overcome just in terms of dealing with triggering material. Harkening back to difficult times in my life, but not going back there, being aware that this was triggering material when I was writing it, and being able to use parts of myself, coping skills, parts of my coping skill box that I've accumulated over the years, and go, okay, this is getting too intense. I need to take a break. I need to take the rest of the day off and do something mindless. Or, oh yeah, I remember 3 weeks before, when I remembered who I was and I was doing, you know, pretty well, I was taking breath work classes, or I was going to yoga and then doing those things. Then taking off the rest of the day from writing and doing breath work. And then suddenly now I'm adding the confidence of realizing I can deal with triggers a lot better than I thought I could, especially at the beginning of this week. And I'm back to doing breath work, which is only helping further stabilize my very destabilized nervous system, which had gotten fully out of whack over the last, you know, during the little cocktail of bad feelings, right? And then I noticed the more I wrote, you know, the prompts were asking me, you know, things like talk about a time that you had to be really courageous, or talk about a time that you had to juggle a lot of things at the same time. And so I went from being so lost and so cloudy in terms of seeing, you know, where I'd come from, to having to dig back in very specific ways into my past, into ways where I showed tremendous courage and tremendous resilience, where I had shown enormous amounts of creativity in being able to juggle all my responsibilities. And I was awakening those feelings again of being capable. And I was reminding myself that, yes, that was who I was. And the feelings that I had been having over the last few weeks, where I was just kind of knocked off balance, indeed did not define me. My whole life defined me, and the body of work that I had done to get to where I was and to get my kids to where they are, those were what defined me. And my future, as yet unwritten, will define me, and it can be whatever I want it to be. And I woke up from this place of complete and utter despair and just cloudiness. Not just despair, but confusion and fear and loneliness, like just this shell of a person, like, who the frick am I? To this, I remember who she was, and she's done some incredibly badass things. And were they traditionally recognized? Did I work in, like, the corporate world where I was paid big bucks? Was all the therapy that I've done in all the various types of ways for myself and for others, unofficially, of course, just because I wasn't paid many, many thousands of dollars for that, does it make it any less worthwhile? Absolutely not. And because right now I'm also writing in a way that I'm trying to sell myself to this illustrious program, right? I'm framing everything I've done in the best possible light. And I'm being honest and authentic, but I'm not also like listing a whole ream of my failures or perceived failures or my like confusion or my fear for the future. I'm just digging into the highlight reel, which was precisely what I needed to be doing at that point. And so here's my next tip. If you are struggling to feel confident about yourself, if you're like, who am I now? If you're in some kind of like no man's land, midlife crisis or whatever, your kids have left you empty nest, or you're not quite an empty nest, or you just don't actually know what the hell's going on because this has been the most destabilizing few years, I would recommend that even if you're not interested in applying for grad school or a new job or anything, writing a fake essay that sells you and all of your accomplishments. Use the same prompts I had. Use the prompt, write about a time where you showed a lot of courage, or write about a time that you had to juggle a lot of different things and you did so successfully. And then sit with it for a while. And if right now you might just be like, no, I don't want to do that, I'm too depressed. Okay, that's okay. But put the seed in your mind. Put it in your mind and let your subconscious work with it, because it will. I have faith that it can. And if we will fill our mind with just the hint of those thoughts, we can open it up to even more of the thoughts. And it takes a stunningly small amount, a stunningly small shift, shall I say, in perspective to feel significantly better, or at least to open the gate to doing things that then will add to more things to feel significantly better. So like I say, I was forced, because of this essay writing, to tune into things that were actually quite difficult and triggering. But then I was recognizing, but look how much better I'm doing than I used to do with triggering stuff. And look, my coping skills are such as that I know to take the time. And then in taking the time, I was getting exercise. I was leaving the house. I was going for a run in the woods because I knew that was important in managing the triggers. And I was going to the breathwork class, and I was adding back the yoga. And little by little, my nervous system was responding to all of these things. Because when you're feeling depressed, and your nervous system is feeling destabilized, one of the worst things that you can do is to just lie in bed still with big wide open eyes and just listen to your own toxic thought loop. It really pumps out a lot of chemicals that are not helpful. I can tell you that for sure. So that is what I did. And honestly, yeah, it was not a good summer, and it culminated in a horrible, horrible, horrible couple of weeks there. But I am so grateful that I listened to that little tiny voice that was like, reach out. And that other little tiny voice was, it is time to do that thing that you always promised yourself you would do, even though you feel the least equipped that you ever have in your entire life since you were 3 years old, to do it. Talk to somebody else about how you're going to do it. And honestly, there were people in that trusted group who were like, listen, keep open to the fact that this might not be the time. And I actually did acknowledge that, because I knew that it wasn't loaded coming from them. They were not afraid of me doing it for any reason. They were just looking out for my best interests, and that was fine. I could say, yeah, I could see that. I can see that, but it's still nagging on me, so I want to give it at least a try. I want to at least, you know, just kind of put that little nagging voice, that very loud nagging voice, to bed by giving it at least a try. So maybe I'll just do a stab at one application. Maybe that's as far as I will go. And honestly, maybe that's all I need in this season. Maybe, you know, that application is where it begins and ends. But that's that for this season anyway. We'll see. But that perspective shift was everything in getting me out of what would have been an ever spirally spiral, which was feeling super scary, not just for me, but for the people that I love. And so I just really want to offer you words of encouragement that that little shift might be closer and more within grasp than you imagine it is. Because when I reached out at that moment, I couldn't see anything ahead of me. I couldn't see any value in myself. I felt so completely just like empty and shell-shocked and memoryless. I just felt unworthy in every way, just like a husk, and just no energy, just no energy. It was just scary. It was scary to move through the world feeling like that. But that life-changing shift was so close. It was just within my grasp and not very far out. It was right there in the next lane. I just couldn't see it. So you guys, I feel you. I feel you so hard. If things are so hard, I feel you. And I my heart aches and breaks for the pain. It's so damn real and it's so hard. And please don't shame yourself for it. Things that are hard, that you feel are hard, and you're like, it shouldn't be this hard. Yes, it should. Screw that. I heard a podcast on Glennon Doyle's We Can Do Hard Things. One of the episodes, her sister ended with the most exquisite rant that I would like to just like print out on my wall and just make it repeating wallpaper, about how back in the days, we used to farm. Everybody farmed. Go and listen to this rant. The way she put it was exquisite. She was like, the moms farmed, the dads farmed, the kids farmed, the neighbors farmed, the grandmas farmed, the grandpas farmed. Everybody farmed. And when the farming was done, we went to sleep. And then the next day we woke up and we farmed. There were no demands on us. There was no getting the kid into the right school, the right preschool. There was no like extracurriculars. There was no judgment on what food you were feeding your damn kid. There was just like what was available, what you farmed. There were no questions. There was just, you know, everybody working on one basic thing all the days of their life until they died. And it was highly uncomplicated, even if it was rugged and difficult and stressful in its own way. We now are expected to do everything. We're expected to have kick-ass careers and incredible home lives and amazing kids who go out and do phenomenal things in the world despite their circumstances, their personalities, their disabilities, or ours, or our lack of, or, you know, our circumstances. everybody is expected to be good at everything, and everybody connected to them is expected to be good at everything. And by the way, it will never be enough. No matter how much you do, it will never be enough. And this is what I was ranting to with my friend, who's one of the most badass accomplished people I know, by the way, and was just like, dude, it doesn't feel like I'm doing enough. I was like, are you kidding me? If you don't feel like you're doing enough, if you don't feel validated in what you're doing right now, there is no hope for any of us. And I remember the times where people were like, how do you do it all? And I was looking at them going, like, what like delusion are you laboring under? Clearly, I am doing a horrible job of everything. I could not be doing a worse job. But the way they saw me was like, I was doing great, right? And I probably freaking was. I was probably killing it, and I probably am now too, and probably so are you. Because all that we are required to do as human beings is be human beings and exist. We are enough as we are, and I know that every single thing in the world will tell us opposite. That is not true. It's not true. You guys, it's just not true. We don't truly have to accomplish a single thing that will add to our worth. It will not. If you don't do a single thing from henceforth and forever until the day that you die, your worth will be as equal as it was the day that you were born and everybody looked at you and said, oh, so damn cute. She's perfect. We love her. Bring to her the food. Do for her all the things. Even though she does nothing but scream and shit herself, she is perfect and we love her and serve and revere her. And then so somewhere down the line, everything changed. But that's a tragedy for another day. That was their perspective, that your worth never, ever changed. It was the world's perspective changed and reflected on us, and it's all a big hot mess since then. But your worth is exactly the same as the day you were born. And you could do literally nothing else. And I tell my kids all the time, and I mean it with all my heart. I say, you are as worthy to me right now as the day you were born, and nothing you do between now and the day that you die could ever change that. And I wish that I could feel it for myself as potently and realistically and powerfully as I feel it for my kids. But I know that it is true for them, so it has to be true for me, right? And therefore, it has to be true for you too. So, yeah. Let's just kind of soak in our awesomeness and then go ahead and do whatever it is that we want to do. And if it's grad school, cool, do that. If it makes you feel good, or if it's not grad school, dropping out of it right today, this very same day, then do that too. Because you don't have to do it to be more worthy. You really don't. You've already like peaked at full amount of worth. You're just polishing that gold medal by, you know, at this point, you're just polishing. It reminds me of Ferris Bueller's friend Cameron's dad, who had the car, the magnificent sports car, and his dad kept it in the garage and would never allow anybody to drive it. And Cameron says to Ferris when he wants to drive it, he goes, this car doesn't get driven. My dad just looks at it, admires it, and rubs it with a diaper. That is it. And that's what you're doing. You're looking at your, you know, you can sit and look at your life as this magnificent vehicle, because that's what it is, and rub it with a diaper for the rest of your life and not drive it if you don't want to do that. And it will still be worth the same amount. It will. And, you know, that analogy goes haywire once you do start driving and depreciation. So just forget about it. Just leave it right there where it is. Just leave it. Drop it right now. It was an ill-conceived analogy. We'll forget about it. But I hope that the message comes through somehow that I'm trying so very clumsily to convey. You're enough. We all are. And we should not believe every thought that we have. In fact, did you know that most of our thoughts, thousands of them, we have thousands of them every day, are the same? Can you believe it? Most of the thoughts that we have, the thousands of thoughts that we have every day, are the same. And some of them are really just dumb and worthless and could just be thrown out. And we'd be just as well off, or probably better. So really, don't believe every thought you have, especially if it's not making you feel good. Only believe the ones that make you feel good. let's try to do that for a while. And if we can't find any thoughts that make us feel good, just like I couldn't a couple of weeks ago, then find you a group of people who will give you thoughts that make you feel at least a tiny bit better. All you have to do is reach for one tiny shift, and upon doing that, the good feelings will start to grow. And sometimes that tiny shift involves getting therapy or getting on the right kind of medications, but the shift is never as enormous as you might feel, and it is never as out of your grasp as you might feel. And with that, I leave you. I apologize if you heard a lot of crunching. I have the tendency to wave my hands furiously when I speak, even when I am in a completely empty room. Blame this on my mix of Greek and Italian and throw in some Scottish. I don't know if the Scots wave their arms around frantically, but I'm going to assume they too are demonstrative. And if you heard a lot of crunching, that would be my shoulder. It's crunchy. It makes a crunchy sound, and I'm sorry about it. But I've noticed a lot of crunching in my ear. So if you did too, that was it. That was it. And if you have any recommendations for how to fix a crunchy shoulder, it doesn't hurt or anything. It's fine. But let me know. Don't let me know if you're like, it means you're old. I'm not interested in that. Okay. I'm not interested. Thanks so much though. Be well. I hope you guys are hanging in. Reach out for the good feelings and good thoughts, or at least the good people who can feed them to you, and know that you're enough. Love you, and talk to you soon. I hope. Bye.